Hi, I'm Madison Williams here with Carla Walker to talk about her experience with the Oklahoma Humanities. So to go ahead and start off, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've been with Oklahoma Humanities for 20 years. I sort of started my career later in life. My first career was a stay-at-home mom with my kids, and then I went back to school and graduated from Washburn University with an honors in English. And had some wonderful internship and work experience while I was working on my degree, as an adult rather than a young student out of high school, which got me some great publications experience. And that's what I came to the council with as far as what my job would entail once I went to work. I hired on at Oklahoma Humanities as their PR and publications officer, which meant that I believe my title was development and public affairs officer. So half of my job was fundraising and half was communications work. Public relations, writing letters, putting together brochures for our programming, and such as that. So, the publications side of my job was something that I had done for a while and had, some great experience to go into the job with. Fundraising was a different matter. Before that, the only fundraising I had participated in was as a volunteer for different organizations, writing press releases for them, writing a letter or two to ask for funding. But at the time, Anita May was executive director. She hired me and said, if you're a good writer, I'll send you to fundraising school and we'll figure the rest out. And she was right. I mean, if you know how to write, you can write a fundraising letter. I learned, I went to some classes and got some experience with grant writing, which I did a lot of in my first 7 years while she was executive director. That my job was pretty much 50-50 fundraising and communications. And then after that point, when she retired, the executive director became Ann Thompson, at which point my job started to lean more toward communications and publications. Shall I stop there or keep going?
You can keep going if you want. How did you make it into your current position? You advanced forward when Anne became executive director, but was there another step up in your career to get to the point where you're at now?
Yes, when Ann Thompson became executive director, in about a year, it was clear that more and more of our programming required publications and communications. So I became director of publications at one point. Director of communications was a title that I once had. And then in 2008, we made the decision to launch our magazine. It was the first in the history of the organization. Very few humanities councils were doing magazines at the time. So it was a big step for us. At that time, the consensus of not only state humanities councils, but other organizations in general, was that online was the way to go, that paper publications were dead. People would move all their reading online, and that posed not to be the case. Not for us. We experienced that, paper programs and brochures were things that our constituents asked for and kept around. So we made this giant leap to do a magazine, and not knowing you know, how it would be accepted, but hoping for the best. And it has been really, really successful. So once the magazine sort of caught on, that became my full focus as editor of the magazine since 2008. And then just about a year ago, I added associate director to my title. So I'm associate director of Oklahoma Humanities and editor of our magazine.
Okay, so you mentioned, you know, kind of in your early days of the organization, you were involved in, you know, fundraising, mm-hmm. But it was in a different way that you had been before. What was it like getting that different perspective on fundraising and grants?
It let me know that, for one thing, fundraising is a real job. I mean, it's challenging. As any organization would tell you, any nonprofit who has to raise funds, it's challenging. And at the time, state humanities councils still do, and still to this day, receive an appropriation from the federal government through the National Endowment for the Humanities. And when I hired on in 2000, it was very much the thing that state councils did most of their programming and their grant making, if they did any, through those federal funds. And raising funds on their own as individual state humanities councils was not being done. It was just getting off the ground that councils were realizing, you know, federal dollars are not permanent. They can come and go at any time. And they realized that private fundraising was going to have to be an essential part of existence from that point on. And then that's when councils began to hire on either development, fundraising, full-time professionals, or they split the job like mine was. And it's very common for state humanities councils to have one position that does both development, fundraising, and communications. I learned a lot. I went to the fundraising school in Indianapolis, at the University of Indianapolis. It was a very prestigious school at the time. I learned a lot. And as I said, we really didn't have a formal fundraising program. So after I went to those classes, I developed sending out appeal letters, you know, 3 or 4 times a year to our constituents, as well as introducing our board to the fact that it was vital that they participate in giving to the organization. That had not been an expectation before that time. But as I began to write grants and ask for grant funding from corporations and foundations, I quickly realized that they expect to see board participation in raising funds. You know, in their estimation, if your board is not giving to your organization, they don't think it's that vital. So why should a corporation or foundation underwrite you with support? So that was an important element of our fundraising as well, to get our board on board, so to speak, with giving their individual gifts, as well as supporting whatever other efforts we were doing on a fundraising basis. And we encouraged them to tell their neighbors, their colleagues, their acquaintances about the organization, gave them some written materials to help them sort of have talking points and direct them to our website and get them familiar with us and start receiving some of our publications in the mail. So that's kind of how fundraising got off the ground for Oklahoma Humanities.
So then eventually you kind of turned away from fundraising and, you know, your position became more publication focused. You mentioned that you were there when they launched the magazine in 2008 and that it was like one of the few magazines by Humanities Council. What was the most difficult part of launching the magazine?
You know, for one thing, the first hurdle was how to fund it. And this was sort of my brainchild. We had had a publication for decades called Humanities Interview, in which we more or less did a newsletter style publication. It was more than one piece of paper. It was sort of styled like a newspaper with about, you know, 16 pages. And it was mostly content about our programming, and perhaps we called it interview because on occasion we had lecturers come through town and do, you know, conferences or lectures for us, and we would interview them and feature that in our publication. So as I saw mail coming through our organization, I noticed the National Magazine from the National Endowment for the Humanities was very impressive about showing the scope of work that the national organization was doing, and that a couple of state councils, Louisiana, I would say, Florida, and Oregon were doing magazines that had more content than a newsletter. They had some articles by scholars who were either working with their programs or doing humanities research. And so to me, that said, there could be a publication that is actually a program. Our magazine is not a newsletter. It is not the purpose of it. Its mission is not to provide marketing for the organization or do fundraising, even though those are sideline benefits of the publication. We conceived it as a program itself, that most of the content, say 95% of the magazine, is pure humanities content written by scholars, so that it serves an audience that we weren't reaching, people who could not leave their home to go to a program that we might be supporting in their community. Perhaps it was rural Oklahomans who didn't have a library to go to for a Let's Talk About It program. Libraries and universities and such as that could have access to materials written by scholars, have the benefit of that research, and more or less have a piece that could be a conversation starter. In general, when we started the magazine, I should go back and say that the first hurdle, as I said, was funding. And so instead of paying for the magazine as a marketing piece, or as a fundraising piece, which would increase our costs there and is very frowned upon for nonprofit organizations to spend a lot of money on that, we decided it's going to be a program and we're going to pay for it with program dollars that we either received through individual donations or foundations, and perhaps if we needed it, some of our federal money could be used on programming. We traditionally have used those funds also to do grant making, to pass along those dollars to smaller nonprofits in Oklahoma that were and are doing humanities programming. So the first hurdle was funding the magazine. Our board saw a lot of potential there for a new audience to give us presence and visibility in our state by doing a really stellar publication. And the other hurdle was getting people to write for it. Because, you know, not every scholar in Oklahoma or outside of Oklahoma knows what the Humanities Council is, weren't necessarily familiar with our work, but we started with a few of them that were doing other programs for Oklahoma Humanities and ask them to write about their expertise. So it was a sort of a potpourri of different subject matter in the first few issues of the magazine. And then as we paid attention, current events were sort of dictating that we speak to what was happening in society in general. For instance, when Barack Obama ran for president, it seemed to be a national conversation. The presidency was a national conversation. And that's the time, you know, say 2 or 3 years into publication that we decided we're going to pivot and not just have a variety of, you know, non-intersecting articles. We were actually going to choose a theme for every issue and ask our writers to speak to a certain theme and have several articles about the same topic. So it would seem like a conversation on paper where the reader would be exposed to lots of different viewpoints, very different perspectives, and different humanities disciplines all talking about one topic. It could, you know, the topics could be, we've done the Vietnam War, hope, the idea of home, comedy, just general things that we experience in the human condition. That we could offer new perspectives on by publishing a magazine.
So the magazine was definitely a way for, you know, Oklahoma Humanities Council to really reach out into different audiences, you know, rural, educational. And you mentioned that it would affect the presence of the organization in the state. How did it affect the presence?
People who didn't otherwise recognize our name suddenly recognized the name of the magazine, and they saw it in the library, or their neighbor had a subscription and passed a magazine along to them and said, "You have to read this." I can't tell you how it happened. I just know that people reacted to the content in a big way, and they started passing it around to talk about the topics in the magazine. We got letters often from rural communities saying that at the coffee shop, somebody got their issue of the magazine and one of the articles was interesting to them and they started a conversation about it. We've had organizations ask for copies of the magazine so they could deliberately start a discussion group using the magazine, you know, as the text instead of, say, a book for a book discussion and such. So, I think when you do a publication and you do it well, people take notice. Another successful thing I think we did was reach beyond Oklahoma writers. We do obviously send out calls for article proposals first to Oklahoma writers and scholars, and then we fill in the issue and the theme from national and sometimes international writers. And so that gave people a wider perspective. Our magazine was hitting topics and an audience that other magazines in Oklahoma weren't. I mean, I would say that one of our sister publications at the time were, say, Oklahoma Today, which is the state of Oklahoma puts it out, Oklahoma Today, and a lot of our content is crossover, but we also include national voices. So readers could be exposed to a wider perspective than just Oklahoma-based topics. And another sister publication that we got advice from and looked up to at the time was World Literature Today, that comes out of the University of Oklahoma. And their audience is very much international. So it showed that, you know, it showed that Oklahomans were interested in more than their single communities or their single state. They like the idea of knowing, where does Oklahoma fit into a larger national and international perspective? You know, another thing you asked about how we got presence in the state, I think another element of that was that we started winning awards. We entered the publication, we do every year, for journalism award competitions. We have the state chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, which we enter different categories for writing and design. And also a regional competition called the Great Plains Journalism Awards, which involves competition among 8 states. So it's a regional competition. It's very prestigious and the competition is stiff. And in our first year that we entered that competition, we took awards and we advertised the fact that we were award winning. And that not only helped us gain presence with our constituents, it made us credible with the media, which would pay more attention to our press releases. And it gave us presence on a national scale within the humanities community, because very few councils were investing the money for a magazine. It does take a considerable amount of money if you look at the total budget. But if you look, if you divide it down to a cost per person for this magazine that is rich humanities content, you're talking about $1.50 per copy for any reader in the state to have access to that magazine. That is a very small cost per person. And it has the ability to have as wide a scope as we can find funding for it. You know, it's renewable, it's sustainable. We can replicate it for great numbers of people if we can just raise the funds to print more of them and mail more of them. It's one of the few programs of that type that one or two people can generate that thing, but it goes to, you know, a huge audience, whereas other programmings are very staff intensive and need management for each little group program to happen. It also takes people outside of our organization for our programming to happen, takes other nonprofits to pick up our programs and do them. Whereas the magazine goes directly to the user, to the reader. And so it has legs of its own, I guess I would say.
So you've been with the organization for over 20 years. How has the organization changed while you've been there?
When I came on, the programming that had, I guess I should say, there were two distinct parts, and really still are two distinct parts to our mission and our outreach. One of them is programming that we generate ourselves. And the other piece of it is the grant making that I talked about, where we're granting funds to other organizations doing their own programming. We had a couple of programs when I started that had been going on in Oklahoma for decades without much change. And they needed to be overhauled, or, you know, we took stock and decided that maybe our constituency was changing. There have been periods in our history where we really focused on, say, secondary school students and teachers, and we served them as a piece of our audience. And there were other times in our history where the board felt like that audience already is being funded and supported, you know, as well as could be in the state of Oklahoma. But the adult population that had graduated from college or high school, who didn't have access to education and cultural opportunities, that was the audience that we needed to serve with programming. So I saw sort of through 20 years, a focus in the beginning of my tenure that was very focused on schools and providing programming for museums, like to tour traveling exhibits and such as that, to a shift where we were serving the adult general public with things like book discussions, where they could go to their local library and have a scholar come in and lead a discussion about a book, you know, every few weeks on a theme, to have people in conversation. So when we made those shifts in constituency, we also made shifts in programming. And so some of the early programs that were, you know, in existence when I came on, eventually were rotated out of what we were doing in favor of putting those dollars towards other programming that would better serve the audiences. We saw it at that point. And as our board saw it, we rely very much on our board to help us have a picture of the state. Our board is statewide. We have membership from all over the state, not just Oklahoma City or Tulsa, for instance. So they are representative of their own hometowns and communities and can tell us what programming is suitable for their communities, what their communities need, and what they think is sustainable for the organization to continue to do. So I would say shifts in programming have been an important observation, I guess I could say, that has changed during my tenure. Certainly the need to be very involved with fundraising, maintaining support for the organization, continues to be an important element of our work. We can't do programming without it. We can't meet our mission without funds. And in order to widen our mission, we have to raise money beyond what the federal government appropriates to us. Yes, those dollars are incredibly valuable and they leverage a lot more. But if we want to better serve larger numbers of people, we have to bring in funds to do that. So that's another important piece that I see during my 20 years has changed from, we don't really need to try that hard in the beginning, to, yes, that is a focus. We need to maintain our attention on our budget. Do we have enough funding for the programming that we have? And if we don't, we need to look at that and see how we're going to either adjust the programming, adjust the funding, and such as that. That's, I guess, likely the largest changes that I've seen in 20 years is the programming focus changing and the importance of doing our own fundraising as an organization.
So how has this shift to more adult oriented programming, really affected communities? Have you seen a rise in discussion about topics, especially considering like the magazine or, let's talk about it.
I can tell you that our constituents love discussion. They love Let's Talk About It, which is book-based, and having that as a common discussion piece. And they love the magazine because it's a lot of different perspectives in the same space, of pages. Maybe you could ask your question a little differently to let me know where you want me to go with this.
I just want to see what impact has, the programs had on rural communities. We talked about how the magazine, increased, knowledge of the organization and increased discussion. But have you seen any adults who have really benefited from these programs?
Yes. We started doing annual reader surveys. I wish I had some of them at my fingertips to read you the comments from our readers, because they do say things like, Oklahoma would not be the same without this magazine. I'm an 80-year-old woman. I can't get out of my home, and yet I feel like I have cultural programming coming to me. It's sort of a lifeline to those groups. As I was saying, just anecdotal commentary, both as feedback in the form of what I call reader letters or reader email that sent directly to me as editor, or to in response to the magazine that we print in the magazine, as well as people writing comments on the reader survey. They're not just ticking boxes on the survey to say, I liked this topic, or it's the right number of pages. They're actually taking the time to tell us, I pass this on. I don't keep my copies. I pass them on to people that I think would be interested in the content. Or they say, I keep every copy of every magazine, and it's on my coffee table for people to come in and look at. Some people have said, I discovered your publication in the library, and now I want my own copy. I want to become a subscriber. How do I do that? So, the feedback is anecdotal, but the quote unquote powers that be, people who track trends, tell you that you can multiply your feedback by an X factor, that if you had feedback of X number of people, you can multiply that by whatever number to judge the fact that many, many more than those people are engaging with what you're doing. So, without actually handing you the results of a reader survey, that's what I can tell you, is just that we get very, very little negative feedback. But I embrace the negative feedback because it tells me if someone is bothered or motivated enough to tell me that I've gotten something wrong, or they have a different opinion, or, you know, something like that. It tells me that we made them think. We stimulated some part of critical thinking for that person. And I respect that. I respect people giving us feedback. It's a lifeline, not only for the reward it is, because it is 99% all positive feedback. You know, it's rewarding as the editor to get that, but it's also important information for our board to know that we're meeting a mission with that publication. It's worth the dollars that we spend on it, because people do say that it changes their community, it changes their conversation, it changes the way they think about the world, the way they approach voting as a citizen and participating, you know, in civic dialogue. So.
So how have you personally benefited from working with the humanities, from interacting with the humanities, or, you know, just even the organization?
I would say that this is my job that I am paid to do, but this is also my life's work. I am very fortunate that we have worked into this space where my job is, this magazine is my full focus. And when that happened, I can't tell you how rewarding it is to do that work. I learn something new every day. With every different topic of the magazine, I feel like I get sort of a mini PhD in the topic, because it requires not only working with authors to craft their work to speak to our audience, but it also takes a lot of time to do background reading, to do the fact checking for the article to make sure that it's on point and communicating correct information. So my education is not just the content they send me. It's a lot wider than that. I have to do a lot of research and a lot of reading to understand what the scholar is writing about and to figure out how to put all of these articles and information together in a format that speaks to the general public. So let me just back up a minute and say that up until the last 5 years, scholars at universities, professors, were not encouraged to engage with the general public. Their focus was the classroom and the student on campus. Our mission is to engage those humanities professionals with the general public. So most scholars are used to writing for an academic audience. They submit material to academic journals. That the audience for academic journals are other academics. So the language and the conversation is in a much different place, different jargon, sort of non-conversational, but more informational. My job as editor is to help that writer, that scholar, craft their writing in a conversational, educational way to speak to a general audience rather than an academic audience. So it's a partnership. That's another piece of this job that I absolutely love, is working hand in hand with the writers to help them move sentences or, you know, choose a word that's not quite so high and mighty that someone has to have a dictionary to look up, to encourage them to write like they were writing for public television, that audience, encouraging them, finding the materials that will illustrate their article well. It's just, it's like curating an exhibit or an experience for the reader, in which I'm putting together the best writers that I can find on the most interesting topics and helping the reader synthesize that at another level by adding visual images, you know, archival photographs or artwork by artists to help them interpret what they're reading in the fullest manner possible. So that's a long way around of saying that I feel like my dream, this is my dream job. I really actually, it's bigger than my dream was. I didn't know how rewarding this work would be. I'm moved, obviously, just thinking about the fact that I have the feedback that tells me that my work matters, that it makes a difference in people's lives, even if it's only one person that I've helped connect with our mission. It is, it's the best thing ever. I just feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
So what is the value of the humanities? We've kind of touched on this a little bit, but why do you think that they're so important, you know, to society, to, you know, individuals and, you know, their health and especially mentally?
Well, the humanities are the record of human experience to begin with. And if we don't pay attention to our history and what society has attempted and been successful or attempted and failed at, if we don't look at that and learn from it, we're going to make some of the same mistakes or reinvent the wheel, so to speak. Humanities disciplines, you know, for the benefit of whoever may listen to this recording someday, history, literature, philosophy, study of the law, these are the things that not only tell us who we are as humans and what we've accomplished, but they make us think. It's vital that we are thinking beings if we want to participate in a shared society. If we want to be citizens, it requires participation from us. And to be successful citizens, we have to be able to think critically, to make judgments that are based on evidence, not rumor. And I think that being steeped in the humanities, being exposed to them, not only offers you a personal education, but helps you engage with the world in a different way than you would if you weren't exposed to the humanities. The humanities, I believe, help us think in a larger, grander way, to have aspirations, to take what knowledge we do have and do something with it instead of just sitting with it. It motivates people to public service, to teach, to vote, to participate in a larger society. And that's really important to the future of the human race.
Okay, that is all I have for you today. Is there anything else you would like to say?
I think we've covered it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to me today. It was an absolute pleasure.
Okay, thanks, Madison.